I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Colleen Roberts. You may begin.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Good morning, and thank you for joining us. We're really excited to be able to offer you this program today. We're going to be concentrating on C. difficile and antimicrobial stewardship, and we have identified some of our hospitals in our project that we think have some best practices to share, and we thought this would be a great opportunity to do that. I'm going to be really upfront and say that this is the first time we have offered a three-hour virtual conference. We tried to listen to you from our two face-to-face conferences that we had and took the evaluation seriously when we saw comments that it was really hard to get away from the office and to travel for face-to-face. So we thought we'd try this and see how it works. So there's an evaluation form, and the slides have been emailed to everyone that registered, but if you didn't get them, they're in the chat. There is a link to take us to your our website, and you can get them from there. With me today here is our team at IPRO, Vicki Agramonte, Bill Gardner, and Ruth Welch. So we are anxious to get this started and see how things go. So I know it's long, and we're hopefully going to just keep things rolling pretty quickly, and if we can get done early, that would be great. But what I want you to do is use the chat function. So if everyone can see where there's chat over on the right-hand side, we're going to be monitoring that. If you have questions during the presentation, please use the chat, and we will ask those questions for you. If something's not quite right, just type it into the chat, and we will try to respond to you as quickly as we can. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ruth Welch.
Thank you, Carlene. Today we'd like to begin our session to discuss antimicrobial stewardship program. We realize this is just part of the C. difficile prevention. However, it's an important one, and also it's part of our 11th scope of work, that part of the project that you signed up for, and so we want to discuss it just a little bit today. The following slides will be discussing why we think it's important, what it means for your facility, and we're actually going to give you some resources as well. To begin it, I just wanted to let you know that the CDC estimates that drug-resistant bacteria causes 2 million illnesses and approximately 23,000 deaths per year here in the United States. So in September of 2014, President Barack Obama actually made an executive order to combat antibiotic resistance bacteria. And with that, he actually, there was a U.S. government task force that was formed. And with that, they organized the task force, and they actually came up with a national action plan for doing just that, for combating antibiotic resistance bacteria. You can read the entire document. It's there for you. The link is there. But I'm not going to go over the whole document with you because that would take 3 hours, but I am going to address just a couple of things regarding that. In March, when they rolled this out, the task force created a five-year action plan. So this is over 5 years, and really, in all honesty, they made it so there's goals and there's objectives. So you see the five goals there. What's really important is to look at the last piece. So by 2020, the bottom of the slide, the implementation of the National Action Plan will lead to major reductions. And they're really looking that they would reduce the threat of C. difficile by 50% from the estimates from 2011. What I want to discuss today is really just one of the goals. And it's the goal one. It's to slow the emergence of resistant bacteria and prevent the spread of resistant infections. So like I said, they have a goal, and with the and some of them can have multiple objectives, but I'm going to go for the first one. And it's basically to implement public health programs and reporting policies but advanced antibiotic resistance prevention. And really, this is the key, and foster antibiotic stewardship in healthcare settings and the community. Antibiotic stewardship, what is it? It's the right antibiotic at the right time, the right dose, for the right duration. And you would know, if, by adding the right patient, that is your five medication administration rights, the five rights to medication. So we know this is nothing new. We should be doing this. So, however, it's become very, very important and evidenced by the National Action Plan. As I stated before, it's over a five-year period, but really what they're doing now, NHSN has even begun the process of part of that action plan. And what they're doing is, within this current year, NHSN, so the National Safety, National Healthcare Safety Network, is actually looking at what your facilities are doing in regarding antimicrobial stewardship programs through the survey that you took this year. They ask you specific questions on what you're doing, what's your current process at your facility regarding that. So that's already done. That was part of the action plan. So what's the future expectation? I think this is kind of important. CMS will issue new conditions of participation or revise current guidelines to advance compliance with recommendations in the CDC core elements of hospital antibiotic stewardship program. What are those core elements? Well, we're going to be addressing that in just a few minutes. But I wanted to let you know, okay, that was within 3 years. What's really going down the pipe? What can we look at? So within 5 years, the CDC is going to work with selected hospital systems to expand the use, to expand antibiotic use reporting and stewardship. And not only in the healthcare facilities, but they're also going to target and work with and develop in the nursing home setting as well. Also within 5 years, all states will establish or enhance antibiotic stewardship activities in the healthcare delivery setting. So what does that mean for your facility? It means it's going to be a focus. If you don't have an antimicrobial stewardship program, now's the time to begin one. And if you already have one, now's the time to look at it and readdress and see if there's more things that can be happening within your walls of your facility. The CDC actually has this resource that's noted in the National Action Plan, and it's called the Core Elements of Hospital Antibiotic Stewardship Program. As you can see, there's seven core elements listed here. I do have the website listed as well. This is a great resource. It tells you where you, if you haven't begun a program, where you should start. And it also shows you where in our facility do we need to work on some tracking and more improvement. So leadership commitment, what does that mean? It really means that your leadership is committed to dedicating human, financial, and IT resources to help you get where you need to go. Accountability. Accountability is really pointing a single leader responsible for the program's outcome. And successful programs really have seen that it is the physician leadership that makes that so successful. Drug expertise, that is appointing a single pharmacist leader for working on improving antibiotic use. And in action, and as you go through this document, it's implementing at least one of their action suggestions, like, for instance, an antibiotic timeout after 48 hours. Tracking is really monitoring what you're prescribing antibiotics and your resistant patterns, like an antibiogram. Reporting. Reporting is regular reporting information of antibiotic use and resistance back to the doctors, the nurses, and relative staff. Education. Education is that continuing education about your resistance and optimal prescribing patterns. Now, how is this done? How can what tool can you use to see how you're doing in your facility? In the back of this book, there is a checklist, and it is the checklist for the core elements. And you can see this is just one page of it, but then the dark area is really the elements that you're looking at. Those are your core elements. And they'll ask you yes or no questions. What I suggest that you do is just go through the document, whether it's a team effort or just the pharmacist and a doctor and the IT. Just go through this and just be honest and check each one. And where there's no, that's the things that you really, really need to concentrate on. So if you haven't, like I said, if you don't have one, this is a great tool to start a program with. And if you already have one, it's always good to go back and look and say, where can we make our program more robust? So after using this tool with a few of my facilities, you know, there was a lot of discussion about, this is great, we can take it back, we need education for our prescribers. You know, what can we do? I wish there was something, a resource that they could take with them or something, like a checklist. So that was a great idea from some of the facilities. So what I did is I brought it back to the team here, along with our pharmacists here at iPro, and we also had some input from some facilities, and we came up with this. It is an antibiotic stewardship prescriber checklist. These are things you may want to follow, just as a little reminder, and it's really making sure that, you know, we're doing all the things are covered that you should be looking at when prescribing an antibiotic. So we have this on our website. We do have a few already printed up. They're in a lanyard form, so you can clip it behind your identification badge. And you can hang it either way. But that's what it looks like. Again, it is on our website. So I want to conclude my little talk with just a little summary. And that summary is, really, you know, why is this important? It's important because, one, the president made an executive order. We've got to get this done. It's a priority. We need to stop harming our patients. Number two is the task force came up with a plan, and it's going to be holding facilities accountable. So to begin or to actually enhance current programs. And number three, you know, it's for our patients, and that's the most important. It's doing the right thing, the right dose, the right antibiotics, the right time, and the right duration. So with that, I'd like to say thank you. And I will, and if you have any questions, please know that you can please put it in chat. But now we're going to hear from Dr. Chen. Pardon me? I did want to remind you that there are also the slides are on the website as well. So if you want to go to IPRO's website, that information is all there regarding all the slides from today. So I do apologize. I should have said that before the program. However, now we have a great opportunity because we're going to hear from Dr. Donald Chen. He is the epidemiologist at Westchester Medical Center. Dr. Chen will be discussing a multifaceted approach to sustained reduction in C. difficile infection. Dr. Chen, thank you so much for joining us today, and I am going to make you the presenter at this time.
Great. Thank you very much, Ruth and Carlene, for this opportunity to address the group on C. diff prevention. This is a topic that when I was approached to talk about what we've done to prevent C. diff infection in our institution, initially, I drew a blank, and that was because there was not one single thing that we did to reduce C. diff in our institution. And when I reviewed what we've done, we've actually done quite a lot of things, some of them specifically targeted towards C. diff. Other things were targeted to hospital-acquired infections in general and had some collateral effect on C. diff. And it turns out that we've done quite a bit, and that's the key to C. diff prevention in our mind is that you have to start, you have to keep at it, and you have to attack it from many different angles. So to go on, this slide is from the CDC's antimicrobial resistance threats report from 2013. It's quite graphic. I'm not going to go through the numbers or stats with you, but a slide I like to use when I talk to various groups throughout the hospital, because it does underscore the seriousness and the urgency of Clostridium difficile infection. You have your skull and crossbones, you have your piles of cash, and so I think all the different groups will understand why this is an important topic. Now, when I think about prevention of C. diff, I think about the pathogenesis to guide what we do to prevent C. diff. And if we go through the pathogenesis, it starts with, first, disruption of the normal gut flora by antibiotics. So the good bacteria in your gut that we all have are disrupted and killed off by antibiotic use for, you know, one of various reasons. That's followed sometime later by ingestion of C. difficile spores leading to gut colonization. So really, by wiping out that milieu of good bacteria, the C. diff spores can then find a place to settle. They find fertile ground to settle in the gut. And then finally, elaboration of toxins by C. difficile, and that's associated with an insufficient immune response that results in colitis. Now, if we look at these three steps in the pathogenesis, we can then think about what we can do to prevent each step along this pathway. So in terms of disruption of normal gut by antibiotics, normal gut flora, that really leads to the importance of appropriate use of antibiotics. Ruth has already spoken about antibiotic stewardship. The idea here is to limit unnecessary antibiotics. We all know that many of our institutions use way too much antibiotics, and we're not advocating we have to cut all antibiotics out, but just use as much as is needed. The next part, how do we prevent patients from being colonized from C. difficile spores? This would then prevent a patient from later elaborating the toxins and having the symptomatic C. difficile. This really will be the focus of today's talk. And finally, are there ways to block the elaboration of toxins or augment one's immune system to battle C. diff and prevent symptomatic C. diff from occurring? Vaccinations might be one possibility. There are studies underway with limited data showing that potentially vaccines against the C. diff toxins could prevent colonized patients from developing symptomatic C. diff, which would help them clinically, but also with fewer symptomatic patients, there could be potentially less transmission of C. difficile to other patients. Okay, now preventing patients from becoming colonized with C. difficile spores. This involves precautions for patients with suspected or confirmed C. difficile diarrhea. These are the basics that I'm sure we're all practicing. Early detection of possible C. difficile diarrhea and contact isolation. Use of gowns and gloves as part of contact precautions. And hand hygiene with soap and water, obviously, because the alcohol-based hand rubs do not kill the spores. The other part of this would be the environmental focus. That involves intensified environmental cleaning and sporicidal disinfection, really bleach for the most part. Bleaching or sporicidal disinfection of frequently touched surfaces within patient care areas, disinfection of equipment between patient use, and room disinfection at discharge or discontinuation of contact precautions. I'm going to take a pause here and talk about two studies. The first study looks at the importance of the environment in C. difficile illness. Now, this is a study by Shaughnessy and colleagues in Itchy from 2011, and it provides insight into asymptomatic carriage. It provides insight into the role of the environment in C. difficile transmission. In a study of 1,770 medical ICU patients evaluated for C. difficile illness acquisition, 1,679, or 95%, were placed in a bed where the prior occupant did not have C. difficile infection. Only 4.6% of the 1,770 were placed in a bed where the prior occupant did have C. difficile infection. Of the 91 patients placed in a bed where the prior occupant was C. diff positive, 10 or 11% went to develop C. diff, a significant difference versus a 4.6 rate of development of C. diff among the group where the prior occupant did not have C. difficile infection. So in other words, patients who are in beds where the prior occupant had C. diff had a greater chance of developing C. diff compared to patients who are in beds where the prior occupant did not have C. difficile, pointing to a role of the environment and carriage across the bed from one patient to the next patient. We know that a major risk factor for C. difficile infection is antibiotic use. In these two study groups, both groups received the same amount of antibiotics. That was not a factor to explain the difference in rates of development of symptomatic C. difficile illness in those patients in beds where the prior occupant also had C. difficile illness. The next study looks at the role of asymptomatic C. difficile colonization as another source of transmission. This study by Kine involved two general medical wards in an academic medical center where patients receiving antibiotics were screened for C. difficile carriage by serial stool studies during their hospitalization. Of the roughly 600 consecutive patients admitted to the units, 271 are enrolled and all completed the study. Over the whole course of the hospitalization, 31% were found to be colonized with C. difficile. About half of these 31% were asymptomatic, and the other half had symptomatic disease. And in both groups, in both the symptomatic population and the asymptomatic C. difficile population, half of the patients acquired C. diff in the hospital, and half of the patients were colonized on admission. So what is this study telling us? It's telling us that first, in these hospitalized patients on antibiotics, only half of the patients with C. diff were symptomatic, meaning only half the patients would be detected by our usual methods of finding someone's diarrhea, screening them for illness. There's another equivalent number of patients who are asymptomatic and potentially shedding C. difficile spores into the environment, albeit at lower levels than the symptomatic patients. Second, half of the C. difficile patients acquired C. diff in the hospital. So it's clear that patients are not simply coming into the hospital colonized, but some of them are being colonized in the hospital, staying colonized, or then going on to develop symptomatic C. difficile infection. So these are both reasons why we have to really focus on systematic disinfection of equipment and surfaces in the patient rooms and hands for all patients, not just limiting our interventions to those symptomatic patients. Now, to get to what we've done in the past few years at Westchester Medical Center, I'll first talk about our hospital. We are a tertiary academic medical center of 643 beds located about 25 miles north of New York City. We have a broad range of services including pediatrics, adults, and a behavioral health center. And we have a number of specialized populations who are at higher risk, a solid organ transplant population, a stem cell transplant population, multiple critical care units including neonatal, pediatric, trauma, burn, neuro, cardiac, cardiothoracic, surgical, and medical intensive care units. Most of the adult patients reside in double occupancy rooms with the exception of ICU patients and some of those on isolation. And all the pediatric rooms are single occupancy. What have we done in terms of patient-level measures to prevent C. diff in our hospital? Starting with the basics, it's contact precautions. This is our contact precaution sign that goes on the door of those patients on contact precautions to remind everybody to perform hand hygiene, in this case with soap and water, upon room entry, don gloves, don gowns, and upon exiting, remove the gown and gloves and perform hand hygiene again. Now, for our isolation precautions, contact isolation is imposed on suspicion of C. difficile diarrhea. Isolation is started pending a test result unless a C. difficile PCR is sent immediately and gowns and gloves are required. So what we're saying here is that patients should be isolated on suspicion of C. difficile, not awaiting confirmation of C. difficile. In other words, for a symptomatic patient with diarrhea that's thought to be infectious where C. difficile might be the cause, they should be on contact precautions right away, not waiting for the test. We do make an exception to that, though, for logistical reasons. If the test is being sent immediately, meaning that we'll have the result in a very short time, in a matter of an hour or more, then the patient can stay put in their current location pending that test just for that hour. But if things are going to take longer, then these patients need to be isolated upon presentation with symptoms, not pending the positive test result. Now, when do we discontinue isolation for confirmed C. difficile patients? Our criterion is that they have no diarrhea for at least 3 days. There's some debate as to what is the right amount of days. It's not agreed upon, but we take a more conservative approach and keep the patients on isolation for a bit longer, because we know after resolution of symptoms, those first few days, the patients may still be shedding larger number of spores than later on. And then, upon discontinuation of contact isolation, the patient is moved to a new room, and the prior room undergoes discharge cleaning, which means cleaning with a sporicidal agent, including bleach and touch-free disinfection procedures, which I'll go into later on in this talk. The idea here is that once the patient comes off of isolation, there still could be spores and probably are spores in the environment, so that we flip the patient to a new room so that that room can be properly disinfected. And we try to message our isolation precaution guidelines to the greater community, the frontline personnel. And we do that by including the guidelines in a simple summary form on the backside of our antibiogram pocket brochure. This is our annual antibiogram. It's a fold-up brochure that can fit into the pocket of a white coat or any place else. And on the front side would be the antibiogram, the antibiotic susceptibilities for all the different pathogens. On the back side is this quick cheat sheet, contact precautions for MDROs and C. difficile. So for each organism, when should contact precautions be initiated, when can patients be cohorted, and when to stop contact precautions. If you look in the green here, you'll see the rules for stopping contact precautions, which I just talked about. Once you stop it, you move the patient to a new room. This applies not just to C. difficile, but to all the different forms of contact precautions for different MDROs. And it underlies a point I've made earlier, which is that a lot of our interventions apply broadly and will have collateral benefit to more than one targeted pathogen. And here we outline our policies for patients with rule out C. difficile and those with confirmed C. difficile. Now let's go on to hand hygiene, which is probably the bedrock of infection control and what we sometimes struggle with most at the same time. As I've mentioned, soap and water for hand hygiene is needed for C. difficile infection, whether suspected or confirmed. And I'm going to show you our ICU compliance rates for hand hygiene throughout the last year or two. This is general compliance, not compliance related to C. difficile patients. And as you see, I have outlined our compliance rates, this compliance using the WHO 5 moments of hand hygiene for adult ICUs and pediatric ICUs. In 2013, our compliance was approximately 86 to 95% across all the ICUs. From 2014 onwards, you can see quarter by quarter that number did see a steep drop to roughly 44 to 64% in 2014 quarter one. And then from that point on, it has been getting better to 64, 65%, up to about 85% in the most current monitored quarter. So what's going on here with that drop? And if you look at 2013 and before, we relied to a certain extent on unit self-reported observations for hand hygiene compliance. Starting in 2014, infection prevention and control took over in insourced observations so that we would be the secret shoppers doing the observations, and that's really where we saw a decline in hand hygiene compliance. In other words, it was probably not a real decline in compliance, it's more like better measurements. So it's important that we do get reliable measurements, and once we started seeing rates of 44%, we fed this back to leadership, we fed this back to the major committees that we report to, and asked the leaders, the doctors, nurses, and other leaders, to lead by example, perform hand hygiene, and help call each other out or remind them to perform hand hygiene. And I'd like to think that this messaging and feedback has had an effect, and as you can see in the adult ICUs and the pediatric ICUs, we've gone up to back to about 85% from roughly 40 to 60%. Moving on, another thing that has been implemented are daily chlorhexidine gluconate baths in the ICUs. This was not done for C. difficile. This was actually implemented to decrease central venous catheter bloodstream infection rates. And this is not a cornerstone of C. difficile prevention, but it's another example where this intervention might have had effects on lowering our C. difficile rates. We can't prove it. It certainly has a role proven again, CVC bloodstream infections, and we might have gotten some bystander improvement from C-difficile rates as well. And I mention that because there is a study here in ITCHI in 2012 looking at the effect of hospital-wide chlorhexidine patient bathing on healthcare-associated infections. And one finding that they pulled out of this study was that the relative risk of C. difficile infection with bathing versus no bathing was approximately 0.71 for 3 times a week CHG bathing and 0.41 for daily CHG bathing. So roughly the relative risk of developing C. diff infection was decreased by 30 to 60% with implementation of CHG bathing. Now, this was not a randomized study. I think more work is necessary. I wouldn't recommend it specifically for C. difficile prevention, but again, interventions for other things may also help to impact C. difficile rates in a favorable direction. Now I'll move on to environmental measures. Environmental disinfection. We've talked about the importance of bleach or other sporicidal disinfectants, and let's talk about routine cleaning procedures for the different kinds of patient rooms. I've split this grid up by pediatric patient rooms and adult patient rooms. In our pediatric patient rooms, the daily standard cleaning involves using a quaternary ammonium compound, which is not sporicidal. Daily cleaning in contact precautionary rooms does involve bleach, and discharge cleaning involves bleach as well. For the adult patient rooms, we've adopted using bleach throughout, so bleach as a daily cleaner for all rooms, not just contact precaution rooms. And this goes back to the idea that there is a reservoir of carriers who are asymptomatic, who could be and probably are shedding, and who will not be on contact precautions. And by targeting bleach in a more universal way or some other sporicidal disinfectant in a more universal way, this is likely helping to decrease transmission from those unseen reservoirs of colonized patients. And previously, a qual compound was used for daily standard cleaning in adult patient rooms. We switched to bleach sometime over 3 years ago. Now, when we think about our specific higher-risk populations, we have implemented a few things. One is cycle cleaning for those longer-stay patients who are immune-suppressed. Some of these patients do stay in the hospital for quite some time because of their medical complexity. And we want to find a way, especially since these patients may be in semi-private rooms, to clean the room and environment more thoroughly. And these are procedures not specifically for patients on isolation, but for all patients on these units. So on the adult hematology oncology unit, on a weekly basis, each room is vacated, a discharge clean is performed with bleach, and the patient is then returned to the room. In the solid organ transplant unit, the same kind of effect is achieved, but in a different way, and this is really based on logistics and processes, what works out best in each unit. So for patients who are in the hospital admitted for 7 days, once they reach 7 days approximately, that patient is moved to a new room and the previous room undergoes a discharge cleaning. So this is a way that we help to target and keep clean these environments with long-stay patients where it might be harder to clean those surfaces near the patient because the patient is there or their belongings are there. Next, I'll talk about another technology for disinfection, ultraviolet light disinfection. We adopted pulse xenon UV room disinfection with discharge cleaning of contact isolation rooms, and we've since expanded that program to include weekly UVD disinfection of all patient bathrooms in the hospital, meaning that on a given day, there is one person who goes around with a UV disinfection machine and systematically disinfects each patient bathroom one by one by one, so that each room is hit once a week throughout the hospital. And has this had an effect? This is data from our hospital published in AJEC in 2014, looking at the decreased incidence of the combined endpoint of hospital-acquired MDROs and C. difficile infection after UV light disinfection implementation. So for this period of time, 2009 to 2011, this is the baseline before UV disinfection was implemented. And you can see it looks fairly stable. And then after 2011 is when UVD implementation was implemented, disinfection was implemented, and we can see that there is a decrease in C. difficile and MDRO incidence rate in the hospital. Antimicrobial stewardship. We can't ignore the importance of appropriate stewardship. All the environmental disinfection in the world might not help if we don't have a proper antibiotic use, and vice versa. The cornerstones of stewardship as we have implemented in our program are limiting inappropriate use of antimicrobials, limiting the duration of therapy, utilizing surveillance data to guide selection of antimicrobials, really meaning trying to choose narrower spectrum antimicrobials where possible, identifying risk factors in areas for intervention where there may be overuse. We do prior authorization of restricted antibiotics and audit feedback on antibiotic use, talking to the providers and discussing when antibiotics might be narrowed or discontinued. So this is a recap of what's gone on in our hospital. The rates of hospital onset C. difficile, the interventions implemented, and the trend throughout time. So starting in 2009, our rate here was approximately a little bit over 7 per 10,000 patient days. And pre-2009, we had our antibiotic stewardship program established. And around 2009 or shortly thereafter, we adopted bleach for daily cleaning of all adult units. In 2010, we switched to the C. difficile PCR assay, which is more sensitive, and this likely accounted for our increase in rate to about 10 per 10,000 patient days. 2011, our UV light disinfection was implemented. 2012 is when we implemented the procedure where when contact precautions are stopped, the patient is moved to a new room and their prior room is discharged cleaned with bleach. 2013 was an improved implementation of the cycle cleaning in the HEMOX unit. 2014, our hand hygiene observations were insourced to infection control, leading to lower reported rates, which were fed back and which are starting to appear to have led to improvements in hand hygiene compliance now. And early 2015, cycle cleaning was implemented in the solid organ transplant unit. So as you can see, we've done a number of interventions. There's no one single magic bullet that led to this decrease. It's a sustained effort attacking C. difficile on multiple fronts. I'm going to segue now to clinical and molecular epidemiology of C. diff in our hospital. And this is some research work that's supported by the New York State Department of Health, looking at the use of molecular typing to help guide prevention efforts for C. difficile infection. It's a project that involves multiple hospitals, including some others on this call as well. And so I do appreciate all the support and work that's gone into this. I'll be presenting data from our hospital. We surveyed and assayed the C. difficile infections in our hospital over a 7-month period in 2014. And if we look at the epidemiology, this is what we see. Of the 135 cases, 60 of them were healthcare facility associated, 27 cases were community onset healthcare facility associated, meaning that they developed C. difficile in the first 3 days, but had been in our hospital in the prior 4 weeks, and 48 were community associated. So it's a mix. Our C. difficile is a pretty balanced mix between healthcare facility and community associated. And if we look at the hospital associated C. difficile cases, we can see the unit of acquisition for the different cases, and roughly a quarter of the cases came from the adult critical care units, 20% from adult medical surgical units, 27% from adult oncology, and the remainder between pediatrics and the vent unit and the step-down units. So that's our descriptive data of the classic epidemiology. Now, we then performed multi-locus sequence typing, which is a method looking at sequence variation in the DNA genes that encode for housekeeping genes. So these are genes that are relatively stable but do undergo some changes. And by typing a number of these genes, you can determine the strain or the sequence type for the C. difficile strains seen in our hospital. And this is a pie chart showing our results. Each color here is a different sequence type. So ST1, this is sequence type 1. This is also known as the NAP1 strain. In blue and red is the ST2 type, in green ST3. This goes along to all the different types per the key to the right-hand side. Overall, of the 124 isolates we had, we saw 34 sequence types. This graph shows all of our isolates. If you look at the hospital isolates alone, the hospital-acquired C. diff isolates alone, you see a similar pattern, just smaller numbers. And the point I want to make here is that we see a high level of diversity of strain types throughout our hospital. There are a few that are somewhat common, but a lot of the strain types you saw, we only saw in one or two isolates over this 8-month period. So we're seeing that C. difficile is probably coming from a number of different sources, both hospital and community acquired and other healthcare facility acquired. We're not seeing a wave or an epidemic of one predominant strain sweeping through the hospital or that has been reported with in other facilities with a NAP1 strain that caused epidemics in the past, but we're seeing a combination of things here. So this really supports the role of diverse acquisitions of C. difficile, including in the community, and it highlights the importance of not only the environmental part that we've talked about, but also antibiotic stewardship, because this implies that people are coming in with C. diff. There's so much diversity, it's not just coming through our hospital only. And then the final thought I want to present is that there really is a need for a system-wide approach to prevention of hospital-acquired infections, including C. diff, including other things as well. This is a modeling study looking at MRSA and prevention of MRSA. So this, by modeling, I mean this is a theoretic study using some assumptions and seeing in the, you know, best and worst case scenarios how many cases of MRSA could be prevented. So what this graph shows is that on the left-hand side of the graph, it's the number of cases or the percentage of cases that can be prevented by one's own hospital, which is in the white, and by other hospitals, which is in the black. And this proportion varies based on the number of hospitals that share the same patient population. So at the one extreme, if the patient population is seen in only one healthcare facility, in theory, in the ideal world, every case could be preventable, and that's where you see on the left-hand side the light gray goes all the way up to 1.0. All cases could be prevented. But as you can imagine, the more hospitals that share that same patient population, and as we know, our patients go to different hospitals, they go to different long-term care facilities, their referral patterns, they're shared among many different places. The more hospitals that share a patient population, the lower the proportion of cases that can be prevented, even if everything is done 100% correctly. So in other words, if you get to about 5 or 6 hospitals sharing the same patient population, you're only going to be able to prevent 75% of the cases in the best case scenario, meaning that there could be 25% of the cases where if the other hospitals aren't doing their work, those are cases you won't be able to prevent. They'll come into your hospital and they'll be vectors for transmission of MRSA or C. difficile or whatever infection. And as a note, this modeling study has been validated in real life with MRSA infections in Orange County, California. So I'll get to the summary of this talk, and that is, first, that multiple approaches targeting transmission and antibiotic overuse are needed to flesh out C. difficile infection. The mainstays include hand hygiene, environmental disinfection, appropriate precautions, and antibiotic stewardship. We must consider the reservoir of asymptomatic patients colonized with C. difficile. And so we must perform interventions or approaches that are more universal in state. In our hospital, that means universal use of bleach in the adult units for daily cleaning, and hand hygiene is a universal thing that should be practiced throughout. We consider targeted approaches for the high-risk populations. It's really important to perform audits and observations with feedback to make sure our interventions are being effectively implemented. And finally, a system-wide approach to preventing C. difficile infection and other HAIs is needed due to accumulating evidence of C. difficile acquisition in the community and the share of patients among healthcare facilities. There are many groups to thank and many individuals and those include our Infection Prevention and Control Department here at Westchester, as well as Environmental Services, Antibiotic Stewardship, and those involved in the New York State Department of Health grant. So I'll finish here, and I will happily pass the ball back to our host, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk today.
Hi, Dr. Chen. Thank you so much. That was a great overview, and I think you really hit it on the nail with showing all of the different things that need to be done to prevent C. diff. It's not just one individual thing. I know we have a couple questions in chat, but I just had one question. How do you handle the visitors that come in with patients that are under isolation? Is there some sort of formal education that's done, a brochure? Do the nurses just try to catch them? I'm just curious, because I know a lot of hospitals struggle with visitors just coming in and out, and they really don't understand what needs to be done because their loved one is on isolation.
Right, right. That's a great question. It's something we struggle with. We have different procedures throughout our hospital. In the pediatric hospital, visitors are expected to observe precautions and wear the gowns and gloves, and they are educated or should be educated when they first come to see their visitors or the patients, when they first come to visit their loved ones in the hospital. On the adult side, we don't practice that in a systematic way. And I think we've taken this, looking at it at a risk-benefit approach and really identifying the risks. Patients who are symptomatic with C. difficile, with other infections, they've likely already had contact with their loved ones at home. And it's a bit of a controversy what is the gain of having visitors put on the PPE. They have likely been exposed at home, and as long as they're not in a multi-bedded room or visiting other patients, and as long as they do perform hand hygiene, they shouldn't be at as much of a risk of transmission of C. difficile to other patients. On top of that, we rely on our universal environmental disinfection procedures to help prevent if spores are carried from visitors or healthcare workers to common touched surfaces. That's been our approach. I think different hospitals approach it in different ways. We've decided to focus more on those areas where we believe a higher risk of transmission, the healthcare staff that go between patients and the mobile medical equipment that might go between patients.
Okay, thank you. I know Bill is monitoring our chat and has a couple questions from there to ask you.
Hi, Dr. Chen. First question is, do you isolate all patients with diarrhea and consider them under suspicion of C. diff?
To the most part, yes. We educate to isolate all patients with suspected infectious diarrhea. If someone is coming in with a chronic diarrhea that has a known cause that's not infectious, we don't necessarily advise to isolate them upon admission. But otherwise, if there's a possibility of infectious diarrhea, we all know we can't just look at it and say this is C. diff, this is norovirus, this is something else. Our advice is to isolate all of those patients on presentation with a syndrome that's thought to be infectious diarrhea. The other side of it is that if a test is going to be performed for C. diff and that's the primary suspicion and that test will come back very soon, then we will allow them to not be isolated for the hour or so while the test returns. But if it's going to be longer than that, then they should be isolated. That is our dictum. Compliance is probably not 100%, but we do constantly try to remind the clinicians and the frontline staff about isolating upon syndromes, whether it's diarrhea, whether it's respiratory syndrome, possible respiratory virus. We are really pushing isolation based on syndromes that might be infectious and transmissible.
Okay. Just a housekeeping measure. Can you pass the ball back to Carlene?
Yes.
Okay.
Done.
And I have another question here. I just lost my chat window. Sorry.
want me to ask it, Bill?
Yeah, the other one is, do you think the increased use of alcohol-based gels has contributed to an increase of C. diff due to the asymptomatic population of colonized patients, and advocate a soap and water approach for all patients in the hospital setting?
Good question.
That's a great question. I can't directly answer the first question not having looked at the data. In our hospital, I don't believe that switch to alcohol-based hand rubs as the first line has led to increases in C. diff, and that's partially because I've seen our rates go down. You might argue that the rates may have gone down even more with universal soap and water hand hygiene, but from talking to other colleagues, you know, I don't think that switching to alcohol-based hand rubs in and of itself has led to increases in C. diff, but I acknowledge that concern, and that's where, you know, personally, I advocate glove use for all patients, even though that's not always needed, just because you never know who might be symptomatic, and even if you're using alcohol-based hand rubs, the spores in the gloves, most of them will be removed with glove use. Now, to the second question about, remind me about the second question. I'm sorry, I just lost the train.
It's really advocating a soap and water approach for all patients.
Right.
Settings.
Right. I don't advocate a soap and water approach. For a couple of reasons. First, I think that would decrease compliance with hand hygiene overall. And second, you know, for a number of pathogens we're targeting, the MDRO bacteria, the conventional bacteria, the alcohol-based hand rubs are sufficient, and not only that, but perhaps superior to soap and water for disinfection for your resistant E. coli's, MRSAs, et cetera. So I think if we went to universal soap and water, we actually maybe would help with C. diff a little bit, but we might see worsening of MDRO rates.
I've got one final question for you. You talked about the UV light disinfection of bathrooms, and it seems like with a facility of your size, that's a substantial capital expenditure for a unit to do that. Can you just touch on that briefly?
Yes. I would say that we are using our UV disinfection in a very targeted form. It can be a high capital expenditure. I don't have numbers on me, but I know that this is a cost is a big factor when deciding whether or not to adopt some of these technologies. And I've seen different approaches about it. I think it's an individualized decision for each hospital. Some hospitals decide rather than spending that money, they'd rather focus on making sure their environmental disinfection is done, is audited, is really highly, highly, highly compliant. I view UV disinfection as an adjunct. It doesn't replace good cleaning, and if cleaning were perfect and done on a very regular basis, then UV might not add much to it, but in our imperfect world, in our hands, UV seems to have added to that. The institution has gone along with this approach, and I think that they are reassured by the data that have come out from this institution showing decreased rates in C. difficile infection. You know, we have two machines right now, which is on the lower side if you're going to adopt it for a hospital of our size, but we've seen improvements. So I would say if you're going to adopt it, you just want to do, and you have limited resources like we all do, it should be a targeted approach. What are the highest risk areas? And in our case, that meant contact isolation discharges that were especially those due to C. difficile infection, not necessary contact isolation discharges that might be due to respiratory virus. And then it meant really optimizing the labor to run the machine with the machine itself so that we minimize downtime of the machine. We're expanding to a third machine and then looking to be able to deploy these machines at night to disinfect areas such as the operating rooms, procedural areas, ambulatory surgery, places that are offline at night so that we can maximize our investment. But it is an investment. It's probably not for every institution, and I think it's an individualized decision.
Okay, we've got a couple of more questions here. Do you feel like colonized patients without diarrhea are truly a risk of transmission, and why?
I do feel like they are a risk of transmission. I think they're a lower risk of transmission than those who are symptomatic. So it's really risk stratifying. I think, you know, the first line of interventions, such as what we've done, has been targeting those who are symptomatic. But once the lower level fruit has been picked, then we do consider that the asymptomatics are also shedding spores in the environment and probably contributing to transmission. It's a bit harder to prove, though. In our study, we're going to start performing swaths of patients to see if they're colonized with the ability to potentially detect transmissions and where they came from in other patients who remain asymptomatic but have a positive C. difficile test. So why do I think it's a source? I think it's just based on principles, knowing that these patients are shedding, but it's a risk-stratified approach, and, you know, once you get beyond the low-hanging fruit, we have to consider those other unseen reservoirs. And while, you know, we have semi-private patient rooms and we're not going to all single-bedded rooms, there are still a lot of things that can be done that are more universal that can target potentially transmitting patients who are not symptomatic, such as daily bleach cleaning of the rooms. Indirectly, daily bleach cleaning of the rooms may have helped our rates go down, and that could support this premise that there is unseen transmission from colonized patients.
And finally, how have you dealt with the long-term breakdown of equipment supplies from bleach? We did a similar all rooms cleaned with bleach during an uptick, but we were not able to maintain buy-in after our rates improved.
That's a very timely question, and we are thinking about that, working on that right now, because all this equipment is breaking down, and it is coming at a cost to the institution to replace the furniture, and it's coming at potentially a cost with patient satisfaction when they see things that are worn down or with a white residue. They think we're not doing our job, whereas that's actually us trying to do our job better. We are hopeful that newer disinfectant technologies will come through the pipeline that will be sporicidal and easily used and adopted. There are technologies out there already, and some hospitals have adopted them or trying them, such as peroxyacetic acid with hydrogen peroxide, that's sporicidal, that does not damage equipment. It may not be prime time for us yet, because it would require a change in our EVX workflows, since this would have to be mixed on a daily basis and replace what's been convenient with the bleach wipes, where you don't have to worry about mixing and concentrations and potential, you know, worker safety or worker safety perception issues. So for us, we're just waiting for the next technology, which hopefully will be a wipe that includes a sporicidal disinfectant that we can easily swap out with our current bleach wipe. But we are struggling with this as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chen. We really appreciate your expertise. I'm going to now make Mary the presenter here. Mary Carell is from Health Alliance at the Broadway campus, and she's going to go ahead and talk to us about really how they did a CDI investigation and a process improvement plan. And I'm going to ask the operator if you could please unmute Mary's line. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Mary Coriel, and I work at the Health Alliance Hospital, and I'm going to be discussing the investigation and process improvement that we implemented for C. diff. Trying to get to the next slide.
Mary, just click anywhere and then hit the arrow at the top. Just click anywhere in their presentation. Thank you. Great job.
Okay. So we started our C. diff investigation when we noticed that there was an increase in the C. diff on our unit. I work on a med-surg unit in the hospital. And in 1 month, we did notice that there was an uptick in our C. diff. So we reviewed each case, and we found it necessary to do a deeper dive, and we did investigate each and every case that we noticed that patients had C. diff. Sorry. We needed to know why we were noticing this. Were there any commonalities that we saw? Were patients been in the same rooms with another patient that previously had been exposed to C. diff? Our next question was what? What were the possible causes that could be identified? Was the staff properly washing their hands? Was there adequate cleaning of the shared equipment on all the units? And was there inadequate cleaning of patient rooms upon discharge? We noticed that immediate action needed to be done. We identified the rooms where patients were exposed to C. diff, and we terminally cleaned them, and we had the curtains removed and replaced. Every room on the unit was cleaned with a 10% bleach solution, whether or not the patients had C. diff or not. All equipment was cleaned with the 10% bleach solution, and all high-touch surfaces were cleaned with the 10% bleach solution. Our action plan included, upon discharge, all patients that had C. diff had to be terminally cleaned with our 10% bleach solution, and that included removing the curtains and having them replaced. All staff were re-educated regarding C. diff precautions. Through huddles, staff meetings, and PowerPoints, that's how we educated our staff on the unit. We asked for our infection control nurse to attend our staff meeting, and that would reinforce our education to our staff regarding the spread of C. diff. We also included our infectious disease physician, Dr. Tack, who provided additional education for our staff. Reinforcement was needed. Our action plan and process improvement. We need to empower our staff to remind others to wash their hands and follow the isolation protocols. This included our physicians, frontline staff, dietary, environmental service workers, and visitors. Hand washing audits continue to be done on a monthly basis on our units. We also did the secret shopper method. Monitoring of already cleaned rooms was performed by the environmental services supervisor and our nursing directors and our frontline staff. Requests for recleaning had been submitted, and ATP testing is performed randomly. We noticed that there was a decrease of the C. diff on the same unit after implementing these. On March, we only had one, April 1, May 0, June 0, July we had 2, and August again 0. I'd like to thank Joanne Solian. She is our infection control nurse for providing us with the PowerPoint, and Carol Schroing, who is our medical director for our MedSurg unit. Again, my name is Mary Coriel, and I was the presenter for the C. diff Process Improvement Project at Health Alliance.
Hey, Mary, it's Carlene. Thank you for your presentation. Can you talk just for a couple of minutes about the process that you use for the root cause analysis? As we go out to the hospitals, we're, you know, emphasizing the importance of it, and obviously it did a lot of good in your investigation. Can you talk for a minute about how you did that?
Well, first we had to identify the patients that had the C. diff. We went and saw what rooms that they had been in, if they had been moved, if they previously had C. diff. We had to just dive deeper into seeing, you know, where these patients, you know, started off and where they ended up and who occupied the room after them. And did they contract C. diff?
And who did you have as part of your team when you were looking at all of that?
We included Joanne Solian. She is our infection control nurse, and then our director of the MedSurg unit, Carol Schroang.
Okay. Was environmental services involved at all?
Yes, and environmental services was involved. They were a big part of our, you know.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, and great job, and keep up the good work. Now, if you could pass me the presenter ball, that would be great. To Carlene Roberts, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce to you Ann Agostino. She is the Ann has been a medical surgical nursing administrator from Orange Regional Medical Center, and she's going to be discussing how this facility engaged the frontline staff with the nursing assistants going above and beyond. So, Ann, it is now yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. Good morning. Again, my name is Ann DiAgostino. I'm here with my 11th scope of work task force group, and they've all promised me they'll be quiet while I do this. And we're very proud to be here, and I just want to thank Vicki, Bill, Ruth, and Carlene from IPRO for allowing us to present our work today. We are Orange Regional Medical Center. We are a large community hospital based in Middletown, New York, a large, beautiful new hospital, the first freestanding hospital built in New York State in 20-plus years. We were built in 2011, and we are a combination of two community hospitals that came together. So we're still blending those two cultures. So a lot going on here. We're going to talk this morning more about staff engagement and engaging the frontline staff in infection prevention. They are key to our work. Nursing assistants in particular spend longer physical hands-on time with patients than any other discipline. And so we really did a great job with engaging our frontline staff. They are truly engaged. Actually, Ruth and Vicki had the opportunity to come up and see our shared governance model on our shared governance day. And originally that model started off as nurses, and we have a very robust shared governance model. We do a lot of great work, but we also branched out, as you'll see in our presentation, to having a nursing assistant shared governance that has done such great work that they're receiving an award this evening for their work in quality improvement. And we're just very happy to be here and share with you what we're doing to engage them. So let me try to page down. Page up, page down. There we go. So in 2013, the Nursing Shared Governance Council was formed, and it was formed out of originally we worked and identified nursing assistant champions. So we formed it out of those champions who were highly engaged. And, you know, I've been a nurse for, I always say, 150 years now. But I feel like a lot of times we gear our education towards the RN staff, and we sometimes forget the frontline hands-on staff. And really the nursing assistants are the ones that are really hands-on, bathing, feeding, doing all this very real work with our patients. And so we really need to engage them, especially in CDI prevention and infection control in general. So the council now is really active. They're actively committed to standardizing their practice. We found that as a big opportunity, that our practice was different on all the units. You know, they would do it different on one unit than on another unit. So their goal is to standardize their practice. And they're working in collaboration with our professional practice department. They're helping really with helping them write competencies, et cetera, and really guiding them along. And they actually led their own annual education in 2013, 2014, and again this year in 2015, which is really incredible. And they went around, they really queried what topics their colleagues felt that they needed education on, and so they've done some great work with their own annual education. So they identified C. difficile infection. We identified at Orange Regional that our CDIs are increasing, and we're really working hard with Ruth. Actually, Ruth and Carlene came this week to speak with us. So we have a problem. We've identified that, and the nursing aides are on board. And actually, in June of 2015, we sent a large group here, 36, Robin, mm-hmm. about 36 members down to the GNYHA-sponsored program for CDI infection, the care coach program. And 10-plus of those employees were our nursing assistants. Again, the frontline, hands-on staff. Very important to engage those people that are right at the bedside with our patients. So they demonstrated a proactive approach in addressing CDI related to proper isolation, use of PPE, and maintaining clean surfaces in the patient's room. Learned all of this information at the seminar and brought it back through their council and brought it to their nursing annual education. So very proactive approach on their behalf. Okay. So the team that attended the Care Coach program, they reported back to the council and wanted to incorporate all that work into the education classes for the nursing assistant, and really, really honing in on C. difficile, and you'll see that in the video that we're going to show you that they created on their own. So year to date, and I think this number is old, and Tracy, maybe you can yell in, that the curriculum's been presented, the entire annual ed with the CDI also, and they have captured over 90% of the nursing assistants, housewives. 98%.
Yes.
The latest number is 98% of our nursing assistants house-wide, and they're really, it's peer-to-peer. The nursing assistants are teaching it. Again, our professional practice educators are really helping them, and they guide them along, but they've empowered them to really teach it. And the staff have really embraced that. They really love to see their peers in a leadership role and teaching them. And I have to tell you that even bringing them down to the Greater New York seminar, they're like sponges. I mean, we really do forget about them, I think, as a key member of, you know, spreading the word of we need to be better at this, we have a problem with C. diff, cussing for safety. We're big cussers here at Orange Region. I always say it's the only place you can go to work and cuss, but I have a concern, I'm uncomfortable, this is a patient safety issue, and we've taught all our frontline staff to do that, especially most of our cusses are related to not using proper PPE and people stopping people at the door saying, hold on, Ruth, that patient's on contact isolation, you need to gown up. Can I help you get your supplies that, you know, you need to do that? And so they're really doing some great work there. Okay, so I'm going to just preface this as a homegrown video, so you need to turn up your speakers. Because the beginning part is a little bit hard to hear, but basically all these people, including the patient, are our nursing assistants. They did this on their own. They developed the video and incorporated a lot of the things they learned at the Care Coach program into this video presentation. So here we go.
Can you share your screen?
Yes, hold on. Let me start it again.
Okay, so just share desktop.
All right, sorry.
Okay.
Where's share? Oh, there, next one.
Okay, got it.
Share.
My screen.
Top one. My desktop. Now can you see it?
All right, now we're going to try it again. Sorry about that. I'm not as tech savvy as I'm supposed to be.
Go back to the... Sorry, let me go get...
Hold on.
You're doing great.
Oh, yay! There we go.
Better?
Can you see it?
Good morning. We're going to be a nursing assistant.
Can we do it again?
No, not good.
What about the workers? We're supposed to use it, but we won't use it this time around. We'll use it next time.
Why don't you guys have a gown on? All the other nursing assistants that came in had gowns on. We're supposed to, but we're not. We'll wear it the next time, and I personally don't like to wear them.
They make you really hot.
Yeah.
I don't like those.
Leave that there. We'll come back to that. Okay. And then have to. All right. What about the white blood pressure card?
This one's disinfected.
This one before we come in,
and
it's disinfected from patient to patient.
What were your names?
I'm Danielle. I'm Billy. Do you need anything right now before we stop out?
No, I'm just figuring out that pain.
No, we'll come back for
don't say no more to the demons, they fill you with fear. Trouble.
We're going to be your nursing assistant today.
May I ask why you're wearing that?
We're going to wear gowns because she's on, your mom's on contact precautions for Edith, and we're going to reduce the selective spread of infections to other staff and other patients that are here and also to you guys.
So just want to come and grab your vitals.
We're going to use the white cup on the bed.
Oh, okay.
Because this one goes in and out of the patient's room, even though we disinfect it, but the white cup is designated okay. For the patient.
Okay. So extend your arms for me.
Okay, your blood pressure is 111 over 54.
No.
Well, it's like okay, so we're going to get rid of the bedpan right now for you guys, okay?
Okay.
Sorry about
okay.
That.
You want to look down the bedpan
while I do this? Do you mind if I throw out your shifts? There were lamps at the bedpan.
Most definitely.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Why are you using the blue wipes? Everybody else can use those ones with the green top.
Oh, because cloth wipes are the only thing that are going to disinfect the fetus.
Oh.
It's going to leave the surface wet for a couple minutes, about like 3 to 5 minutes, so just to disinfect.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on to me as we go. As we roll down this unfamiliar road.
Whenever your patient is on isolation precautions that requires PPE, you should put them on in the correct order, starting with your gown. Followed by your mask. And then your gloves. When you're removing your PPE, you should start with your gown, pulling at the neck, pulling at the waist, rolling into a ball away from your body. Then removing your mask. And always you want to wash your hands.
No, you're not alone. But I'm gonna make this place your own.
Oh, I just
take a mask.
And go to the green bar at the top.
Okay.
And just hit...
stop sharing?
Yes, thank you. There you go.
Ah, all right. All right. So I think I just have one last slide with...
your contact.
My contact.
No.
There we go. So if you any of you have questions about, you know, our work, especially our shared governance, I mean, we only really highlighted what we're doing with our nursing assistants, but we have a great, robust shared governance, and if any of you would like to reach out to me or have questions now, please feel free to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for allowing us to participate. We're very proud.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Anne. It was great. And if you could pass the ball back to Carlene, please, that would be great. Thank you.
If I can find it. Oh, wait. No, I passed it to the wrong person.
Okay, that's fine. Just pass it to Amy, if you could go ahead and just pass the ball to Carlene, please.
Sorry.
It's like playing dodgeball.
Okay. Thank you very much. You all can mute your phones now. Thank you. Very good. Now we're going to have a presentation by a group, a facility group, and it's really asking the questions, where are we? And they're honing on to the antimicrobial stewardship and CDI prevention. And it's our group from Harlem Hospital Center. It's Dr. Hina Faruqi, Delicia Ortega, Chris Charles, Jacqueline Witter, and they're all going to start doing the presentation at this time. And Cecilia, you have the, you should be able to change as the presenter.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. We can.
Great. Good morning. My name is Cecilia Ortega, and I'm the Director of Infection Control at Harlem Hospital. I have with me my team members, Mr. Chris Charles, who's the Assistant Director of Infection Prevention at Harlem Hospital, Dr. Jacqueline Witter, our Deputy Director of Nursing Education,
hello,
and last but not least, Dr. Hina Faruqi, our Director of Pharmacy. We will be presenting in the following sequence. Dr. Faruqi will be presenting the primary strategies that we have implemented to prevent the CDI infection, which is our antibiotic stewardship program, followed by Dr. Jacqueline Witter, who will be discussing the role of the interdisciplinary team in the prevention of CDI. And last, Mr. Chris Charles will be discussing the role of the ICP in the prevention and promotion of patient safety within the healthcare facility. Dr. Faruqi will be following.
Okay, so I'm going to be presenting our objectives. Okay, so our objectives are actually to identify the rationale for our antibiotic stewardship process and the CDI prevention program. We also want to describe our implementation strategies, and with our sustained outcomes, we want to explain the roles of our interdisciplinary team, as well as discuss the improved patient outcomes while minimizing adverse events like toxicity, CDI infections, and resistant organisms and drug resistance. Finally, we also want to discuss improved quality patient care, improved patient safety, while reducing the excessive costs that are contributed to by the inappropriate antimicrobial use. So what was the rationale for developing our antibiotic stewardship program? We wanted to decrease inappropriate antimicrobial use. And as we had mentioned, as I think Ruth had mentioned from the IPRO team, a CDC says about 20 to 50% of all antibiotics prescribed in U.S. acute care hospitals are either unnecessary or inappropriate. So we know that this was one of the major rationales. We also wanted to decrease drug-resistant pathogens. We wanted to decrease healthcare costs, and these are the healthcare costs that are associated with treating the MDROs, the multi-drug-resistant organisms, the side effects, and the adverse events caused by inappropriate prescribing of antibiotics. We also wanted to decrease the length of hospital stay and decrease patient mortality. As, again, Ruth had mentioned, the CDC also estimates about 2 million people are infected with antibiotic-resistant organisms, and it results in 23,000 deaths, so this was very important. The World Health Organization contributes antibiotic resistance to, again, inappropriate prescribing patterns, so this is the wrong drug selection, the wrong dose, wrong indication. Other factors are short supply or back order of effective antimicrobials. This leads to using second and third generation or second line antibiotics. There are also fewer and newer antibiotics in the market, inappropriate duration of therapy, direct to consumer pharmaceutical advertising, self-medication. This is where patients are using antibiotics that they had from prior visits or other family members or other people's antibiotics, and limitations in current surveillance systems. So the tracking of the antibiotic process for trends, that is also one of the limitations. So what we did at Harlem, we said we needed to establish an antibiotic stewardship team. So we did select a team. We met every other month. This team was interdisciplinary. As you can see, these are part of our participants, the Department of Infectious Disease. We had infection control, nursing, IT, pharmacy, and pathology, to name a few. So what we also did at our facility, we selected facility champions. And we did this to ensure we had leadership buy-in. We wanted accountability and sustainability for our program. So this is one step we did take. So who's a part of our team? So as we had mentioned, we have different roles for the different departments. At our facility, we chose to restrict antibiotics, and this was based on the spectrum of activity, the cost, and associated toxicity. So we developed a prior authorization process for antibiotics, and we also selected the ID fellow, and this ID fellow was going to be the antibiotic expert. So before an order was placed, there was a consultation with this ID fellow, and this process was all integrated into our electronic EMR system. Then it was the role of microbiology. They developed an antibiogram annually, and what this helped us do was we can assess the sensitivity patterns of pathogens across our facility. It also assisted the residents and the ID fellows to choose the most appropriate antibiotics. And then the role of infectious disease, which is going to be further talked about by Ms. Ortega, Delcy Ortega, but their role is to track healthcare-associated infections, including MDROs and C. diff infections. So the role of pharmacy, we actually review all orders, including antibiotic orders, for appropriateness. We're looking into the dose, the duration. We're also trying to ensure that pre-authorization process for restricted antibiotics is followed. Our pharmacists also do clinical monitoring, so we're tracking and trending. The pharmacists also join the ID team for daily rounds. We also do a lot of documentation. So we're documenting whenever we have IV to PO switch, drug-drug interactions, wrong dose, duplication of therapy, duration of therapy, and diluent. Here, where I really wanted to add, all these are documented, and we have a homegrown database, and that's used for our tracking and trending. We also work with IT. We developed order sets for antibiotics based on national guidelines and our local susceptibilities. So these order sets had the dose, that they had the duration, the indication. If there was an allergy to a certain antibiotic, we had alternatives on there, and we also had doses for renally compromised patients. We also incorporated automatic stop orders, so it was embedded within our EMR system. So this was very beneficial for our surgical prophylaxis skips and sepsis protocols. So for our IV to PO switch, we developed a clinical criteria. We got the group together, and so anyone that required the IV to PO switch, we made that distinction. And this was communicated through various mechanisms. We used interrupt emails via our EMR system. We made phone calls. We even visited the service during the rounds. And this, again, was all tracked for cost savings. So just to summarize, so first, we have our system where the resident consults with the antibiotic expert, which is the ID fellow. So the ID fellow gets back to the resident, and he puts an order into our electronic EMR system, again, using our established order sets. Pharmacy reviews this for appropriateness. It also goes into a queue for the ID fellow and ID pharmacist to review, and this is what they use during their rounds. And the nurses administer the medication. So what are some of our positive outcomes? As you can see from these graphs, we've actually decreased in prescribing broad-spectrum antibiotics, and now we've narrowed it down to the agents based on the organism and the susceptibility to the antibiotic. And this trend has followed all the way to present day. And other cost savings, as I had mentioned, so our IV to PO has drastically reduced our cost anywhere from 20 to 40%, and our total expenditure for antibiotics has also decreased drastically, and we sustain these results. Dr. Witter will be discussing the role of interdisciplinary team.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for this opportunity, again, coming from Harlem Hospital. I just want to review some key components for the roles of the interdisciplinary team in terms of surveillance and prevention of CDI. The key components are assessment. We assess our patients for signs and symptoms for CDI. We are looking for watery, foul, smelly feces, and immediately we initiate isolation precautions. We also have to make sure that we have the precaution signs on the door, and we ensure strict hand washing techniques. We use the World Health Organization guidelines and recommendations to do so for 20 to 30 seconds, and we use soap and water. We also make sure that education is at the fore end for all nursing staff and also for the patients and their families. Prevention is a key, and education also contributes to this. We also provide keen documentation and daily rounding with the interdisciplinary team. Once the providers, they put in the orders in the EMR, this will generate notification to the admitting office and to our infection control department. Nurses, they document on a daily basis. We communicate amongst the interdisciplinary team, and this is done on a daily basis. We also communicate through EMR, and the isolation list goes to the laboratory, nutrition, environmental services, nursing, admitting transporters, the physicians, material management, and all other department heads. Another key factor is communication, and here at Harlem, we use the SBAR to communicate patients that are identified with CDI. So again, key elements were we assess, isolate, communicate through the interdisciplinary rounding, through the EMR, and key documentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Witter. So Mr. Chris Charles will present the infection preventionist role.
Good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to present to you the best practices implementation strategy at Harlem Hospital that makes us the lowest in the nation when it comes to C. difficile and MRSA. The key to any good infection control program is prompt identification and early isolation. At Harlem, when it comes to C. difficile, that's no different. We are at the forefront when it comes to identifying. We review our labs on a daily basis. We also do review the electronic medical charts, especially for the in-house patients, on a daily basis, and we generate a list from that. And that list not only goes out to the dietary and everybody else, it goes to senior management who looks at that list every day to make sure they're in a follow-up. Daily transmission-based precaution rounds, that's key and that's intense because we're going to make sure that the correct signage is on the door. I got to make sure that people are adhering to strict hand hygiene using soap and water, also the use of the proper PPEs. Real-time feedback, we do that, and that rounding, daily rounding, also gives us an opportunity to do real-time rinse service with our clinicians when it's not being followed. Implementation of multi-drug resistant organism alert record that we have on the EMR, and that's to, when the patient is readmitted, they should be looking at the alert to make sure we put that patient if they came back with symptoms of CDI. Education, that's key for us. On a monthly basis, we educate our clinical staff and another about C. difficile. We also use the glow germ hand hygiene. As part of that is hand hygiene where the clinicians actually do wash their hands using the glow germ, and we look at it under the light to make sure that they're doing it properly, and that's an area for improvement. Vigilance to hand hygiene, so far we're in the 90s, in the high 90s, so we're doing pretty well on that. And as we said, going back to the education for the class, on a monthly basis where they actually get a chance to wash their hands and an area for improvement if they're not doing it properly. And we review all microbiology results for positive cultures that we do on a daily basis and put the patients on as necessary. We, as I said, review the electronic medical record every day for the patients who are suspicious for CDI, and we also place them in isolation. As a result, when the patient comes back positive, they're already in isolation for a couple of days or the day before.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. So in summary, we just want to say for our team, it's been the best practices has been the teamwork approach to preventing the CDI infection and certainly the antibiotic monitoring. The future plans for us is to basically increase the automation into the electronic medical record for a notification to the prescriber, continue with the tracking and trending of the prescribing patterns,
and certainly continue the vigilance for the prompt identification and isolation of patients with CDI among everyone in the interdisciplinary team. And this is all, and thank you very much for allowing us to share our best practices with the team. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Carlene. Thank you for your presentation and congratulations for doing such a terrific job on CDI prevention. Unfortunately, we have some hospitals in a state that aren't doing as well, and we know that some of the issue is dealing with the prescribing physician. So if they prescribe an antibiotic, it doesn't meet the criteria, but the physician is still insistent that the antibiotic is going to get prescribed. How do you guys deal with that type of case? How do you deal with the physician? How did you get your leadership buy-in to do all the things that you do?
Okay, so what we do with our physicians, again, we take a team approach. So it's not only the physician that's writing it, they do have to consult with an expert, and that's an ID fellow team. So this team actually rounds daily with a pharmacist. So if it's something that's inappropriate and you take a team approach, it's not just one person against the other. It's data-based. It's based on our local guidelines and national guidelines. So at this time, I definitely have to say that we do collaborate, and 9 out of 10 times our recommendations are adhered to, and we do track whenever we make any intervention, was that adhered to, and I have to say that for most part, yes, it is. And sometimes, yes, one physician might be particular, and if we can come up with a rationale that this is appropriate for them, we will go ahead and make that substitution. But in general, we have great collaboration because the team approach, I believe, is the best part of that.
Great. Thank you. If anyone else has any questions, please feel free to type them into chat. And I think we did have one extra question after we ended the last from Orange Regional. Bill, do you want to review what that answer and question and answer was from Ann?
Yeah, from the video, they noticed that they put the PPE on inside the room and wondered if this was the process, and don't they just don the PPE outside of the room? And Ann had responded that we do not keep the PPE in the hallways for contact isolation. Our staff don the PPE just inside the door with the part of the patient's room. And for airborne isolation, we have an ante room to store and don our PPE.
Okay, thank you. So, Alicia, could you please pass the ball back to Carlene Roberts, please?
Okay.
Thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Click on her name. Cart, we've got to get back on.
That's okay.
Yeah, fine.
Wait a minute. We can. 1 second.
Click you, and then click yourself. Yeah, and now click on Carlene.
Where's
Carlene?
We don't see Carlene.
We don't see Carlene on our line.
All the way up at the top?
All the way at the top it should be.
Scroll up.
Under panelists?
Scroll up.
No?
You guys, those who doesn't want.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Ann, it's on you. Could you?
Ann, it's on you.
Could you send it to Carlene, please?
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Scroll by the side.
Scroll by the side, Marcia. By the side, the little button.
Okay. Thank you, Harlan. We really appreciate it. And now you can go on mute. And Ann, if you could just click on Carlene's name. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you, Ann. Thanks for being there. Okay. Well, now we're going to have Eve Bankert, from former Director of Infection and Prevention and Epidemiologist from Ellis Hospital, talking about an antimicrobial stewardship initiative, an antibiotic stewardship initiative, regarding an antibiotic pocket card.
The camera's still on.
Okay. Go ahead and just talk, Eve, and hopefully we can. And up the page down. Okay. And then go ahead and talk. Okay. Good morning, everyone. And Carlene and Bill, thank you for inviting me to this great presentation. I really enjoyed all the information, and it's just great to hear how many hospitals are doing the same things, doing the best practices. And I'm just going to share. A small initiative that we started at Ellis, and hoping it's going to lead to bigger and better things with regard to antibiotic stewardship. Unfortunately, antibiotic stewardship sometimes gets forgotten as far as initiatives to decrease HAIs. Usually that's a result of lack of resources or lack of time. But to be effective, strategies should be reasonable to implement and something that could be sustainable. So we try to keep this in mind with all the initiatives that we do. Sorry, just having a hard time getting my slides to advance. Okay, great. So I'm just going to briefly, there's been a lot of great presentations talking about antibiotic stewardships at other institutions, so I'm just going to hit upon some of the key ones that we have done at Ellis. In 2010, we formed a multidisciplinary antibiotic stewardship team. We had pharmacy, infectious disease, infection control. We even invited other institutions to join in with us, and, of course, environmental services. And we met approximately once a month. It would vary depending on how busy we all were, but we try to at least meet every other month. So some of the initiatives that we were successful in completing was we wanted to look at our antibiotic stop dates, our automatic stop dates, and we felt that 10 days, this was just too long. So we were successful in decreasing that to 7 days. We continued to evaluate and expand our restricted antibiotics, and this has actually helped quite a bit, not only with calls to pharmacy, but also in educating providers that aren't infectious disease specialists to know which ones were restricted and therefore use them prudently. Now, the most effective strategy that we used was focused chart review with interventions. This was, like I said, the most effective in driving change, but unfortunately also the most labor intensive. So that only lasted for probably about 6 months or so, but we did get some good results with that. We also transitioned to having the pharmacy do the dosing for aminoglycosides and vancomycin. Another thing that was initiated quite recently was that our multidisciplinary patient rounds were to include the pharmacist. Currently, the MedSurg ICU and the Neuro ICU and one medical unit are involved, and the plan for the future is to expand this to all of the units. Of course, during these patient rounds, the pharmacist would look at the IV antibiotics that the patients were on and see if there was a reasonable PO switch. Also, de-escalation of antibiotics, usually with regards to the culture review, see if they can use a smaller gun as opposed to a bigger gun to treating the patient's condition. And ultimately, what the goal is the discontinue all antibiotics. So another initiative that we undertook were point prevalence studies. Now, point prevalence studies are a great, they're efficient and an effective way to get a snapshot of prescribing patterns that are going on in your hospital. The three key things that we learned from the point prevalence studies that we did was, first of all, we found out that the percentage of patients that were admitted to a hospital, our hospital, on any given day mirrored the CDC data, which was approximately 50%. Another thing we discovered was that there was a lack of microbiology data to support antibiotic prescribing. In other words, a lot of these patients that were admitted on antibiotics did not have follow-up cultures taken. And the last thing, which actually was no surprise, was that we found out that core measures drive compliance. And the way we found this out was that one of our point prevalence studies had to do with the pneumonia pathway, and it was no surprise that we found out that there was 100% compliance with the antibiotics.
So why did we choose the initiative of an antibiotic pocket card? Well, we felt as an institution that we really needed to do more with not only educating clinicians, but also providing them with a tool to a quick reference, so to speak, to refer to when they didn't really know, what antibiotic to choose for what condition. So this, I just want to make clear that this quick reference guide is not meant as a comprehensive Sanford guide for all antibiotic prescribing, but rather something that is handy to the providers that they can reach in their pocket and refer to. The card itself is 3.5 by 5.5 inches, so it's small. It can fit in a lab coat pocket, either your front pocket, your side coat pocket, for ease of use. It's inexpensive and fairly easy to update. And then it should also address some of the other initiatives that all antibiotic stewardship programs address, such as decreasing C. diff rates through prudent antibiotic prescribing, aiding in preventing antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria, saving money spent on antibiotics, and decreasing length of stay. So what does this card look like? The front of the card, we wanted it to be somewhat of a checklist, a first view of, why you're using this card. First of all, big question is, does this patient really need an antibiotic? It seems like a silly question for an antibiotic card, but we really do want clinicians to ask themselves this question each and every time they prescribe an antibiotic. Also, review the allergies. Verify that it's an actual true allergy and not just some, reaction the patient had on an isolated incident. A big thing that we are working on from an IT standpoint is an indication for prescribing the antibiotic. And this is really kind of comes back to the very first point of the checklist. Does this patient need an antibiotic? What condition are you treating? And if you come up short, then perhaps the antibiotic isn't necessary. Consider PO versus IV. Can this condition be treated with an oral agent rather than resorting to IV antibiotics? Importantly, obtain a culture prior to initiating empiric therapy. And also utilize any available microbiology data for selection. And lastly, but not unimportantly, is cost. So you open up the card, and you'll see two separate antibiograms. The one, on my left, which I'm assuming is your left too, will be your gram-positive organisms, and the one on the right is your gram-negative organisms. This antibiogram reflects the same one that is shown on our hospital intranet, but we thought it would be easier to have it right in your pocket there, and it's updated twice a year by the microbiology lab. And then the back of the card, which actually is in the process of being revised to shrink it up a little bit, get rid of some of the antibiotics and antifungals that aren't used that often. So it's probably going to end up being about half that size. So we're going to list the most commonly used antibiotics in our institution, and the ID restricted antibiotics have been identified on the card as well. The relative cost is going to be indicated with dollar signs like you see in a restaurant. We didn't want to include the actual cost for a couple of reasons. We thought it would be too busy. We want this to be a quick reference guide. And secondly, it would have to be updated on a very frequent basis. So by having the dollar sign kind of a key, we thought that would be a quick way for clinicians to glance and get a relative feel for, which antibiotic they wanted to prescribe. So next steps. So this pocket antibiotic card is really somewhat of a stepping stone for a more sustainable system. We wanted to draw more attention to antibiotic selection
And we also wanted to provide clinicians with an easy way to access this information. An intermediary goal would be perhaps to provide an online link to antibiotic guides, one such as the Johns Hopkins. It was one example that we've looked at, and also to continue to utilize the hospital intranet to access the antibiogram. Now, the long-term goal, which I imagine is probably not going to be that long-term a goal for a lot of hospitals, and perhaps hospitals are already doing this, is to provide this information to clinicians' smartphones. This obviously would be ultimate because everybody always has their smartphone with them, and they would be able to not only bring up, places like Johns Hopkins information, but also access hospital-specific information. So I know I kind of ran through a lot of things pretty quickly, but I know that a lot of the previous presenters had already touched upon a lot of the key elements of the antibiotic stewardship program. So this is just one little thing that we're trying to do to increase awareness. Thank you.
Thanks, Eve. One question I have, and if anyone has any questions, don't forget to type them into chat. When you did your point prevalence study, how did you pick? What did you do it on one unit? And if yes, how did you choose that unit?
So the point prevalence studies that we looked at the admission list every day. And I'm going to go with the pneumonia one. And what we did was we looked at, because on our admission list, it would have the reason why they were being admitted. So any patients that were admitted with a diagnosis or a rule out of pneumonia, we looked at their antibiotic, what the antibiotics they were admitted on, and then we followed them throughout the course of their admission until they were discharged. And that's pretty much how we zeroed in on our population for our point prevalence. We never really looked at just one unit. We looked more at diagnoses, and the other thing we looked at was antibiotics. So we looked at patients that were admitted on, for instance, Zosyn, Benko, Clinda, just using as an example, and then we followed those patients throughout the course of their admission. So we never really zeroed in on one specific unit.
Okay, thank you.
Eve, can I take you back to the beginning and the formation of your committee? As to who felt that there was a need to do this and who generated the formation of the committee? I mean, did it come from administration? Is it your medical director? Is it your pharmacy director? Who got involved in that process initially?
So initially, I will say that it was myself and the director of pharmacy that we felt there was a need to, because I had come from the microbiology lab, which I had been in for a number of years, and created the antibiogram and got it onto our hospital intranet, but I was wondering how it was utilized. So one thing led to another, and the director of pharmacy and I got together and said, we really need to look at not only how is this being utilized, but how are we doing as an institution in providing clinicians with the tools that they need to better prescribe antibiotics, and also with that get a better understanding of what antibiotics should be used for what disease states. So it was really a collaborative effort between microbiology transitioning into infection prevention and pharmacy.
And does your committee report to whom? Where does the antimicrobial committee report to in the structure?
So we report, our subcommittee would report up to Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee,
okay,
which would ultimately report up to the Board of Directors. So, every month we would report out to Pharmacy and Therapeutics.
Okay, thanks. There is a question here that do you have plans to create antibiograms by patient unit or by clinical service line?
That's a great question. And it was one I actually asked myself. Seeing as this initiative is kind of in its infancy, we would like to expand it to kind of zero in on, ultimately specific providers, not only just a unit, but a specific provider. And one thing that I forgot to mention about the point prevalent studies is one of the great takeaways that you can get is that through doing those, you can identify areas that you need to do focused education. In doing one of the point prevalency studies, we did such just that and ended up doing presentations to this group of clinicians. So, at some point, I think it would be a good idea to look at specific units and specific service lines with regards to antibiotic stewardship. But to get, but before doing that, you really need to get an overall lay of the land and figure out where your institution is, you know, as a whole with regards to antibiotic prescribing patterns. Great question.
All right, thanks, Eve.
Okay. Thank you, Eve. Now for our last presentation, next to the last presentation, sorry about this. We are going to have Amy, and I know she was there, so let me get her.
I'm here.
Okay, Amy, here you go. Thank you so much. I'm going to pass the ball to you to make you a presenter. I just had to find you first.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, Amy, why don't you go ahead and just, I'm sorry, this is Amy Cristimio Harris, and she's from Rome Hospital. And why don't you get started, and then I'm going to pass, when you see your slides, you can advance them once you click in them, okay?
Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not seeing my slides just yet. There we go. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. And again, thank you very much for inviting Rome Hospital. This has been an excellent resource, and it sounds like there's so much great work being done out there. We're really happy to be a part of it. I am the Director for Infection Prevention here at Rome Hospital, and my mentor was Leanna Grace, who basically started the program about 26 years ago, a very different time. So I have inherited a wonderful program from her, and I'd certainly like to mention her today as well. What we have done here at Rome Hospital is in 2014, the end of the year last year, we did partner with iPRO for the 11th scope of work, and I'm not seeing my slide.
Since you go down, page down, use the page down button. Please.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, that's right.
So we did partner with iPRO for the 11th scope of work to look at healthcare-associated infections, and what we basically chose at Rome Hospital was to really focus on were our C. difficile infection rates. And we have done kind of a two-pronged approach where we've really spent a lot of time in developing our antibiotic management program, and we've also set some goals for ourselves as a facility for reducing our C. difficile infection rates. Because surveillance and antibiotic utilization are so important, one of the things that we recognize is we really need to get a handle on who's in the house. Where are these folks coming from? What are they bringing in? What are they taking from us? And kind of get a snapshot of the demographic of the persons that we're serving. So I did identify that need as being something that was a key component, and I did develop a screening tool that I utilize in conjunction with nursing assessment and also with our empowering our nursing assistants, our boots on the ground, our RNs, our emergency department, physicians, to recognize early symptoms and potential C. difficile risks and take proactive steps. So we did create an evaluation tool to kind of help assist us with screening for early identification for C. difficile infections, and we are utilizing best practice guidelines. We look at recent antibiotic use, any healthcare influences that they've had. We look at their current or previous MDRO statuses. In our current EMR, we have the ability to flag multi-drug resistance histories and keep them, whether or not they're colonized or active infections. We do have that ability at your fingertips to pull it up, and we choose to flag past histories of C. difficile infections because of the high predisposition for reinfection. We also recognize that there are so many external influences that are in a past medical history, including, you know, current or recent bowel manipulations in the form of surgeries or endoscopy procedures. We look at any lab or radiological reports in the form of CAT scans. Just kind of a really comprehensive approach to reading through the chart and trying to stratify these folks. For infection prevention, the admission database, we did add our question on the admission database. Have you been admitted to a healthcare facility within the last 30 days? And that had actually fallen off of our database when we converted over from paper to electronic. And we re-added that, so that is also a flag for me when I'm looking at who's new overnight in the house to go and focus on those persons who are current admissions that may have had a healthcare influence. We utilize it as part of our ED triage process, and we also, of course, added the infection prevention screening tool, which will be coming up shortly. So this is the screening tool that we did develop here at Rome Hospital, and you can see where it does look at recent admissions to a healthcare facility, including nursing homes and rehab. It looks at any surgical procedures, including dental, because we do have a lot of folks that don't consider dental influences as a medical influence. So it's just kind of, you know, asking those pointed questions and taking little bits and pieces of seemingly unrelated or unimportant information and being able to utilize them as part of our screening process. We look to see if the admissions have been treated outside, whether it be from their family doctor or an urgent care or prescribed any new medications. We look at, of course, antibiotic influence, and we take it out 90 days for those folks that perhaps don't think that the Levaquin or Cipro that they received, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago has anything to do with what's happening to them today. We look at the usage of antibiotics. We look at whether or not they do have an MDRO history. And, of course, we will ask them if they have any undiagnosed diarrhea or have had any recent experience with diarrhea, watery stools, following those CDC guidelines of 3 or more in a 24-hour period. We'll ask them to give us, on your worst day, what was happening to you and where are you now. We certainly include any known or potential exposure history. And also, we do ask about a PPI. You know, the linkage may be questionable, but it's certainly something that we want to incorporate in our assessment plan. So our view at Rome Hospital is, as an infection preventionist, you're an educator. You're a staff educator. You are a physician educator. You are a patient educator. And we really strive to be accessible. I have the luxury of working in a small community hospital, so, you know, you kind of know everybody and pretty much everything that's happening, and I think that has been something that has been very beneficial for us because when we do try to put an initiative forward, we have immediate access to the parties that we're trying to reach, the frontline staff, the physicians, the patients, the pharmacy. We have included our pharmacists in our multidisciplinary rounds, which we do on our acute care areas each morning with our hospitalist group. We also include all of the ancillary staff, including our social workers, and everyone is utilizing the same C. diff surveillance tools. So we've got a lot of eyes on the same prize here, and it's working for us because we have taught out symptom recognition and some of the risk factors and influences to a multitude of groups so that infection prevention isn't working alone to try to reduce the risk for our C. difficile rates. So we look at medications. We encourage our staff to look at, of course, their electronic medical records and their medication administration record, and are there things on there that are influencing what's happening with a patient? You know, the laxatives, the stool softeners, the lactulose, have they received any IV electrolyte replacements, you know, things like that? You know, did we mean to do that? Are we trying to induce loose bowel movements from an obstruction or what have you? So, you know, knowing your patient and knowing what your intended outcome is will also help whether or not this person has an infectious diarrhea versus a non-infectious component. We also look at the dietary components. Are there food-related causes for any symptomatic diarrheas? You know, have we identified potential food allergies, or is there something going on in that particular realm? And we do isolate until proven otherwise. So we have empowered our staff and encouraged them to please any undiagnosed diarrhea or any suspicious rashes or anything related to any MDRO, put them on isolation. We can always figure it out. What we don't want to do is find out later on into the care and have potential exposures to things. So we are very proactive in our isolation of persons. We do use PCR techniques, so we do have about an hour turnaround time for our C. difficile samples, and we certainly can rule in or rule out fairly quickly. We also utilize NHSN guidelines, of course. So we do encourage the staff to make sure that they are early identifying persons coming into the house for that community involvement. And, again, going back to Westchester County, it looks like Rome Hospital is right about even Stevens with what they're seeing. We're seeing almost equal amounts of what we would consider a healthcare influence versus what is coming in from the community. So that's something that we're certainly trying to get some better numbers on here, too. And the antibiotic stewardship, of course, the right drug for the right bug, utilizing our pharmacists and our infectious disease specialists as tools, actually, in the care of our patients so that when we are in morning rounds, we're looking at those cultures and looking at what has come back or hasn't come back and deciding whether or not the antibiotic usage is still clinically indicated. What I do as part of my teaching is I will utilize the iPro algorithm when it comes to helping to differentiate between what could be considered an infectious diarrhea versus what has other non-infectious symptom influence. So when I do my teaching with staff members, we do talk about the things that are not healthcare infectious processes, but could very well be as simple as, you know, we've got both Senna and lactulose and colase and such all on board. You know, do you think that there is indeed another process going on here? So I do utilize the iPro algorithm as a very large portion of my teaching because I do want to try to get the staff to be thinking about all of the external influences when it comes to the differentiation between an infectious and a non-infectious diarrhea state. We also realize that patient involvement is really the key in kind of getting our arms around what's happening, whether it be in your hospital or out in the community. The patient has a responsibility and obligation to themselves just as much as we do. So we will put patients on isolation, and we do encourage our visitors to utilize our PPE, and I used this as an opportunity to do some one-on-one teaching with patients and family members. My primary source is the CDC frequently asked question sheet that I do provide to our patients and family members. And I give the patients and their family members a job. And the job is, while that family member is here in the hospital, they're tasked with going home and decontaminating the house and flipping the linen and doing that type of thing. So they feel as though they are involved in their care, and they have a strong recognition of what potentially could be going on. And I think people, too, also want to naturally protect themselves. So when you, incorporate your caregivers with your patient teaching, it certainly can make a difference as far as keeping potential spread under control. We do often see family members who had never heard of these things before, and of course will say things to you like, well, geez, I've been living with them for such and such a time and like that. So it's a great opportunity for us to get involved in the in some community teaching. We teach patients and their family members to put themselves on surveillance. As you know, that C. difficile can certainly raise its head long after the last dose of antibiotic. I do, give them about a 30 or 45-day window to, if you develop symptoms like this again, do not wait. Call your physician. They may want to have a repeat sample sent. You might require a retreatment. And I do also encourage any family members or persons who have come into contact with this particular patient, if we know about it, to share that information with them as well, just to put the entire family on surveillance. I will update the patient medical history because we do have the ability to do that in our current system. So I will add C. difficile infection as one of their problems in their medical list. And we also utilize a bleach cleaning process as part of our terminal clean and encourage family members to do so as well. We also use our antibiotic stewardship program to reiterate the proper medication when it comes to, not borrowing, stopping, or starting antibiotics without physician advisement. Make sure that you're completing your courses because, again, I don't have to tell any of you how it's not surprising what people will do when left to their own devices. So we do take this opportunity to make sure that we mention that type of medication management with them as well. So success definitely is possible, and it looks like so many members of the teams have had great successes. At our highest point, we did have about 12.8 per 10,000 patient days in our first quarter for 2015, and just with the utilization of the iPro project and the antibiotic management program really getting a good push and getting started here with our pharmacy and our physicians, the creation of the assessment tool and the re-education of the staff and physicians, we've been able to really cut that in half in a short period of time. And it is our lowest rate since 2013. So basically, our advice is engage your team. Infection prevention is certainly a team sport, and it can be done. We hope that we can have continued successes because if early recognition is really key, then it's all about a continued staff education. And I'd like to, again, thank you for inviting us to participate today.
Thanks, Amy. It's Carlene. I know that you have really worked hard and you've got a team that meets on a regular basis. Can you just share with everyone else, how did you get the buy-in to form that team to start with and to keep them involved?
Well, at Rome Hospital, we have the luxury of being small enough where the managers and directors and physicians and all of the committees, we all know each other, and we all have a very intimate connection to the hospital. So the team buy-in really when you hit them with the science and the fact that patients are suffering with a CDI infection. It's an uncomfortable situation, and it requires treatment, and it's a very real medical problem, and it's something that can be positively influenced. You're hard-pressed to find people that don't want to get on board with that. So we really kind of took it a multifaceted approach with not only the human element, but also hit them with the science. And we've incorporated our physicians, our building services team, our pharmacy, all of our nursing staff, because each one of us has a role in reducing healthcare-acquired infections. And if the tools are out there, why not utilize them?
Thank you. There was one general question in our chat that you can – certainly respond, Amy, but I'm going to open it to any of our speakers. If they would like to respond, just take yourself off mute. And if anyone on the participant line would like to respond, you can just type in a response in the chat function. The question is, we currently have a stop sepsis as an organizational priority and are struggling here with CDI. Has anyone seen a correlation between compliance with stop sepsis and an increase in CDI? Have any studies been done to look at this? Can anyone respond to that? No? Okay. I know that the stop sepsis work is still fairly new. There's probably not a whole lot out there published about it yet. So if we do hear anything, Anne, we can get back to you with anything that we can find.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Amy, can you pass the ball back to me, please? Arlene Roberts. Thank you very much.
Another question.
Oh, we do have one more question. And this is for Rome, I believe. Amy, you can talk. Your line's still open. What time frames are you using for C. diff healthcare acquired infection definition?
For us, we use the NHSN guidelines. So if it is occurring on the third day, it belongs to our hospital.
Okay.
So it's really about the early recognition and that time date stamping of the admission versus the collection time frame.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, now we're just going to have a summing up to today's events, and we're going to have Vicki Agramonte, one of our team members here, to present. Vicki, let me pass you the ball.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ruth. I have to thank, on behalf of the iPro team, we have to thank each and every one of you, as Carlene said, for your time and your effort. But I think what was just great about this event was the diversity of your interventions. And we had hoped that would be the case, that we would have such a diverse venue that it would be of interest. But, of course, we know sometimes our best laid plans don't always work out. We can certainly say for this event it did work out. So we thank each and every one of you. But we want to just make sure that each and every one of you walk away with your to-do steps. What are you going to take away from this event and make happen in your facility? So just to kind of sum up what we learned today, Dr. Chen from Westchester Medical Center did a wonderful job using evidence. Looks like I might be losing my video, so I'm just going to click off. There we go. Video's off. That's okay. To be able to use the evidence to guide our practice, being able to integrate the evidence into our practice, being able to look at environmental services, and in a critical way as part of our team to prevent these issues from occurring, looking at your long-term patients. I was most impressed with Westchester and I'm talking about any patient who has a length of stay of greater than 7 days, that there is a plan to clean those rooms. We have many of our hospitals that have patients who, in many cases, are living in the hospital. So I think having a place and a process for making sure that those rooms get cleaned terminally should be occurring on a routine basis. I also appreciated Westchester's presentation, how they are targeting the use of UV disinfection. I can tell most of you that a lot of you who have just started using UV disinfection, they're in a quandary right now of the cost is extreme. We know we don't have many devices in our hospital. Where do we start? How do we make that process happen for environmental service, allowing them the time in which it takes for the UV disinfection to be effective? So please take away that those things are things that we need to think about, okay? It can't just be up to our housekeeping staff and how and when to use that disinfection. Our team, Mary and Health Alliance, did a fantastic job of talking to us about how seriously they took their CDI outbreak. And I use outbreak, of course, with the greatest of caution. They identified that there were too many CDI events for their comfort level and did what we've been telling you to do all along. And I think after talking to our team about root cause analysis, we say it all the time, to do it, do it, do it, do it. And we're not quite certain that that folks are really still comfortable drilling down and being critical of their own care. Please engage your quality improvement staff in this process. It takes time to develop a comfort level to be able to say, as a quality leader in your institution, which our infection preventionists are, you are part of a team of quality the team of quality improvement specialists. To say, you know, our process broke down. We missed a moment here where we could have prevented an infection. So it's really hard to develop that. We're going to tell you it comes with time, so don't stop doing it. We know for those of us who have been in quality for decades that when we started doing this, it was really hard to say something we did was caused by our staff. Over time, you learn to word these things in such a way that the learning experience can be valuable to prevent these processes or problems from ever happening again. Certainly, our friends at Orange Regional Medical Center, we know this team well. For them to have engaged their nursing assistants in such a way, I think, is an opportunity that we're all missing. We're going to urge each and every one of you that if you haven't engaged your nurse assistant staff, that you do so immediately. If you have committees that are meeting, we're going to urge you to invite one of your nursing assistants to attend these meetings. I know my friends at Jacoby in North Central Bronx out there do that, and they can attest to the value in having that voice in the room. Also, the peer-to-peer education. You know, it's asking a lot, and it actually speaks to the level in which your nursing assistants are practicing at, because it is not easy to take something you've learned and actually do a train-the-trainer and make sure that each one of your peers know what you know. That's the most effective degree of education, and we know, too, not only have they done peer-to-peer education, but they're also the ones that are on the unit, on the spot, saying, hold it, we talked about this. You know, make sure that your PPE is used appropriately, donning and doffing that equipment. Our team at Harlem did a fantastic job, and I think what we found with most every one of your presentations was the value of an interdisciplinary team and how we make that work. I think what Harlem didn't say, and I know Chris Charles did, but their CDI rates at Harlem Hospital are the lowest that we've seen across the nation. And I know he said that, but they didn't show the rates. Their rates are almost non-existent, not for 1 or 2 years or 1 or 2 quarters, for years. That's where we need to get to, and I think we all can agree that the type of patients that are treated in our New York City hospitals are most definitely different from every other hospital in the state. They are very complicated. They're the most disparate of populations. and to be able to prevent infections in Harlem, as you can guess, didn't only prevent their MDROs. They're preventing every infection across the board. That's an effective team, as most of you have demonstrated today. So, again, don't be afraid to brag about your CDI rates. What was most impressive, too, and I know it's really hard for a lot of our folks to even think of doing, is an ID consult for all antibiotic prescribing. I think all of our pharmacists kind of sit out there and say, oh, no, don't even suggest that we do that. But I have to tell you, that goes along with our folks at Rome being able to do real-time review. It does no value to anyone to do retrospective reviews of antibiotic utilization. The patient's gone. We've already missed the opportunity. So just as we did years and years ago when we started doing core measure reporting, it took a while for folks to say, okay, you know what, the only way we're going to get to 100% is we get out there on the unit and make sure that this is happening in real time. We know how hard that is, but then that can be your goal. Is how do you integrate real-time reviews into your antibiotic prescribing? We've done this with a myriad of projects, and that's what our iPro team is here to do, is support you as you begin to think about how complicated those interventions can be. We'd be happy to help you and coach you through some of the things that we know can be of benefit to you. Our friend Eve has did a really great job of not only again, pointing out that real-time review, but, you know, being able to look at the use of our antibiogram. I think this is something that we don't talk about enough that has significant value. Of course, we're going to thank Dr. Chen for our next tool because I think the fact that we're saying to create the antibiogram by service line, it was the light went off in my mind and said, oh, now that might be very valuable. Or the heavy hitters, the heavy prescribers, to help them specifically prescribe the right antibiotic at the right time. Also, what Eve mentioned was the point prevalence study. I think, again, this is another tactic that's underutilized. When we think of piloting a new intervention, it always turns into a project in itself. The point prevalence study will allow you in real time to gather data and make an intervention based on what you found. I think the way they did it at Ellis Hospital was very effective. And again, we found that our pneumonia core measure certainly is a low-hanging fruit, and we saw that everywhere. A lot of our folks who did audits for CDI in our project found that cultures are not being drawn before antibiotics are being hung. But guess what? In our pneumonia core measure, we found it was being done 100% of the time. Cultures were being done routinely because antibiotic initiation was starting in the ED. Those ED nurses knew that this was part of their protocol, that we must draw a culture before we initiate that antibiotic. And, in fact, the two happened simultaneously. Okay, we're hanging and we're drawing. We need to implement that on our units, get it out of the ED, and get that format, get that thought process onto the nursing unit where the nurse who's going to hang an antibiotic is going to check and make sure that a culture is drawn, ordered, and if it's not, that they're going to follow up before they open up that line. And Rome, of course, you know, these are folks that we've worked with for a long time, and I just have to say to Amy, you did a great job also acknowledging Leanna Grace on our agenda. Leanna Grace was the infection preventionist at Rome Memorial Hospital for over 20 years. Amy didn't mention the fact that she took over Leanna's role at the beginning of 2015 and has not missed a beat since she began. I think any of your IPs out there can agree that the worst thing to do is to step into somebody else's shoes who's been there for decades. And Amy, I think, said it very eloquently that every member of their team has a place in their heart about Rome Memorial Hospital. As many of you have said, your commitment to your hospital and your culture is so obvious to us. So don't think that we don't acknowledge that when we hear you talking. A few things that Amy said, and I just have to say also, that before Rome Memorial Hospital implemented anything, they did a drill down. They did their root cause analysis. They knew exactly what the cause of their problem was. And so we just want to, and also making sure that we encounter, we ask that question of, were antibiotics taken prior to your admission? We look at dental procedures. We can have a patient on antibiotics for 2 months that had no other risk factor. Now they get sick, they're in our hospital, and now they're developing C. diff. So that pre-admission information was critical for them to really get a handle on that. And in case you all didn't know, I'm very excited for all of you and all the work that you've done. Amy, also from Rome Memorial Hospital, talked to us about the algorithm that we developed. We developed that from the SHEA guidelines. I have it listed here for you. We actually, since Amy was one of the first hospitals to use this tool, they've piloted it for us. We've since named the tool. The tool is called ASK. It's Algorithm for Stool Collection. We know a few of our hospitals out there are using it now on the same web page or similar on the same area on our iPro web page. You can find these tools. We also have the lanyard that was developed for antibiotic stewardship. We also developed an audit tool that we know Rome used, we know Putnam Hospital used, we know a lot of our providers tried to use this to get to the bottom of why their C. diff, and to try to quantify antibiotic utilization and its relationship to C. difficile. We also just want to stress with the antibiotic stewardship prescriber card and the tool that Eve developed at Ellis that we're really promoting self-stewardship. Again, we cannot have quality people spend their lives reviewing charts. We need and we know that our young clinicians and prescribers are more apt to go back and review their own work for accuracy. So the art of self-stewardship is alive and well, and we hope that this tool will be able to support that as well as you move forward in your efforts. Again, as Bill has put in our chat, here is the link to the educational session for today. We are urging you to please fill out the evaluation. As Carlene said at the beginning of this presentation, this was, you know, we were hanging on the ledge with this going a couple of hours in a virtual session. And as I've told my colleagues, being on the ledge is never a comfortable place to be. So we appreciate your honest feedback. And certainly, as you all know, we'll modify our approach to meet your needs because you're our priority. And the tools that we just presented are here on this webpage, so we urge you to please use them. And if you have a need for a tool, we tell you this all the time, please do not reinvent the wheel. Contact us first. We will find that tool for you. And if we can't, we'll put it into place and develop it ourselves. And here is our iPro team members. But I think we are certainly early. We are finishing early, which we hope we would. We'd like to invite, and if our operator, if folks can use the raise their hand mechanism or type your question into chat, if you use the raise your hand, we can identify your phone line and unmute you. So please go ahead and ask your questions or give us feedback and let us know if there was something that you took away from today that was particularly exciting. Carlene, with that, I will turn it back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Vicki. I just, again, want to reiterate, we really appreciate all of you that took so much time to put your slides together to speak today. And in CMS's mind, this is what our scope of work is all about. It's about sharing. It's about learning from each other. And, yes, there's a lot to learn from national experts that we try to bring to you periodically, but there's so much knowledge that you've got yourself, so we think this is a really great venue to try to have you share some of the things that that we've seen that you've done and hope that we can continue to do this over the next several years through the course of this project. And I also just want to thank my team because this was a lot of work on our part, too, to try to put it together, and all of my team really worked hard with trying to get everything straight, helping with slides, getting people to practice. So it was a lot of work both by the presenters and by my team. So I thank you to everyone. I don't know if we have any hands up.
Operator, can you tell us if we have any questions? I know we don't have any in chat.
To ask a question on the phone line, they will have to press star 1.
Okay. Can you press star 1 then, please, if you have a question?
Yes.
Or comment? If not, then I guess we will end. And I know that this was a long time to stick with this, so I'm hoping everyone felt it was valuable. So I'll just check again with the operator. Are there any questions?
There are no questions from the phone lines.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again, everyone, and I'm sure you'll be talking to us soon. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.